Hello, this is Kathy Hart, host of the Health First Radio Show. Today we have some really great guests lined up for you. First of all, we have author Annabelle Carmel, and we're going to learn about the first meals for babies revised. And in the second half, we have Terry Mudrick. She's the author of I Can Survive, and we're going to talk about energy. But first, here's Alan with the Health First News.
A new study adds to mounting evidence that COVID patients have an added risk of stroke. Researchers analyzed data on more than 20,000 U.S. adults hospitalized with COVID-19 between January and November 2020. The analysis found that their risk of stroke was higher than for patients with other types of infections, including flu. Lead author Dr. Sati Shakil, a cardiology fellow at the University of Washington, said these findings suggest that COVID-19 may increase the risk for stroke, though the exact mechanism for this is still unknown. The new study found that 1.4% of COVID patients had a stroke confirmed by diagnostic imaging. The findings were presented Friday at a virtual meeting of the American Stroke Association. Research presented at meetings is typically considered preliminary until published in a peer-reviewed journal. At Eating Recovery Center, which offers treatment and services for people who have eating disorders, intensive outpatient and partial hospitalization programs were switched to virtual when the pandemic began. But that didn't sit well with people who were working on their recovery. Ellen Astrakhan-Fletcher, a certified eating disorder specialist and regional clinical director at the Eating Recovery Center in Chicago, said our patients said, "You can't do this. This is not enough support for us." And within a week, we brought partial hospitalization back on site because we realized that the risk to them not getting treatment on site was worse than the risk to them coming out in public. According to recent research from Anglia Ruskin University in Cambridge, England, among those who are facing fear, isolation, and loss during the pandemic are people who experience eating disorders, such as anorexia, bulimia, and binge eating. The findings were published in the April issue of the journal Psychiatry Research. For people hoping to prevent the heart rhythm disorder known as AFib, new research shows that taking vitamin D or fish oil supplements won't help. AFib, also known as atrial fibrillation, affects more than 33 million people worldwide and is the most common type of abnormal heart rhythm. It can cause symptoms that affect a person's quality of life, result in blood clots that can cause a stroke, and also lead to heart failure. For the study, the researchers examined whether taking vitamin D supplements or omega-3 fatty acids found in fish oil might affect different types of AFib, and whether some patients would be more likely to benefit or be harmed by the supplements. Overall, the results were mostly consistent across the different types of AFib and patient groups, according to lead author Dr. Christine Albert and her colleagues. Albert is chair of the cardiology department at Smith Heart Institute in Los Angeles. The study was published March 16th in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Fact. There's very little to laugh about with COVID-19, but some of the claims presented as fact on social media have fact-checkers doing spit takes. The fact-checkers at the Poynter Institute's PolitiFact have shared some of the more bizarre statements of the more than 800 pandemic claims they've investigated in the last year. More than 60% of the claims earned either a false or pants-on-fire rating. Below are some of the things PolitiFact wants to clear up. The nanoparticles in the COVID-19 vaccines can't locate you on 5G networks. Fish tank cleaner does not kill the coronavirus. Cocaine does not kill the coronavirus. Doctors administering the vaccines are not guilty of war crimes. Amazon's Alexa doesn't say the government planned the pandemic. The Simpsons did not predict COVID-19.
We have Annabelle Carmel with us today, and she is the author of First Meals Revised and Expanded. It's a release just for our Canadian marketplace. She's the mother of three, and she's pioneered the way for families all over the world to feed their families. She's the best-selling international author of 45 cookbooks. Well done. And as well as many recipe apps to feed the world. So welcome, Annabelle.
Thank you so much.
It's great for you to call all the way from England today.
Yes, it's London here.
London. Can you tell us a little bit about your background why so much great interest in cooking and food?
It was a tragedy in my life that kind of got me into my career. It took me quite a long time to get pregnant, and then really, it was just a nightmare because my daughter got encephalitis at the age of 3 months, and she died in my arms about 5 days after contracting it.
Oh.
And, you know, becoming a mother and then losing your child, I can't think of anything worse to happen to any woman. It was so unnatural. And I just didn't know what to do with myself. I just had to have another child. I was desperate to have another child. Mm. And my second child, luckily, was, well, I got pregnant after about 5 months after I lost her. But it didn't go plain sailing because my doctor told me that it would be a long time. I was in labor, but I was in the early stage of labor, according to him. But he was wrong, and I ended up giving birth on the staircase to my second child, Nicholas. So Nicholas was literally the world's worst eater. Luckily, he was fine, mm-hmm. but he just would not eat, and he was a terrible sleeper. And I was desperate to get him to eat as a mother who'd lost her child. I just felt like, you know, he needed to have this reserve in case anything happened to him. Mm-hmm. So I started to make up recipes that I loved to make for my family, but I made them in sort of child-friendly ways. And I went up and down the country, all over the country in England, talking to all the experts on child nutrition. And it was a very difficult book to write because so many of these experts contradicted each other on, like, simple things like, when do you give peanut butter? You know, in case your child might have an allergy, should you give it at 6 months, 9 months, 1 year? No one could agree on these simple things. So I ended up writing my book with the help of the greatest children's hospital in the UK, which has a research arm called the Institute for Child Health. So everything was based on scientific research. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, you need to give these foods like peanut butter and eggs fairly early on in your baby's diet, around 6 months, because you're actually going to help your child to be sensitized to them. And in my day, they were telling people not to give peanut butter until the baby was at least a year. And so the incidence of peanut allergy was going sky high. So now they find out it's the opposite, and actually by giving it early, it can help. But having said that, there is one caveat, and that is if your child has eczema, they're much more likely to have a food allergy. And in that case, you have to consult your doctor before giving them any potentially allergenic foods, things like peanuts or eggs or dairy. So, you know, there's two schools of thought. But still, for a baby with no history of allergy and no eczema, then you should be giving these foods early. It will help them.
So, and that would probably include wheat or corn or things like that as well. Any of those five major allergens, you're protecting the child from the allergies later that way.
So I ended up writing a book, and it was published, my first book was published in 1991, and that book sold 5 million copies, but I could not find a publisher for about a year. No one wanted to publish it. Just goes to show you have to be quite determined in life. Right. But I did believe that the book would help other mothers. And for me, it was my legacy. It was my therapy and my legacy because of what happened to me in losing my first child.
Right. Wow. That is a strong push to new creation.
I think it's the why you do something is your passion, isn't it?
It came from the heart. And children's nutrition, obviously, is there's so many different thought processes. So you'd gone to science for the information, and then put your creativity around it.
Yes. So it's all very well saying, you know, babies need essential fatty acids, which basically come from oily fish like salmon. But then how do you get babies to eat salmon? So then I had to make really tasty recipes. So I would do something like salmon's great because you can literally cook in a microwave for a minute and it's cooked. And then I made steamed carrots, and then I sautéed some tomatoes, a little bit of butter, and then I put some cheese with it. And I mixed all those things together. So it was salmon and carrots and cheese and tomatoes. And it was delicious, and babies loved it. And I would get babies to eat salmon from 6 months because essential fatty acids are one of the most important parts of the baby's brain formation, and baby's brain is tripling in size in the first year. So it's very important. And it was explaining to moms what they needed to give, but also tasty ways that the baby would actually eat it.
Hmm. Wow. The baby's brain triples in size in the first few months. That's really amazing. So the inspiration came from creating the food for your own children. Did you find you have more children? Was it there? Did each child need to be fed very differently?
They were all very fussy. And actually, I'm very grateful to them for being so fussy, because literally, if I had had a child who hadn't eaten well, I wouldn't have my career. It's because my child was such a bad eater that I had to spend so much time like developing meals to get him to eat. And each one of my children, like, they were quite difficult in their own way. And so it was really like, it's all very well being a nutritionist, but being a mom with a difficult child, that's how you learn how to get children to eat. Because it's not just about the food, it's about the psychology of eating. And sometimes, you know, we will go into the cupboard and we will give them something else if they say they don't want whatever you've given them. And then, like, mealtimes turn into, like, one-hour battles, and they always know that you're going to give them something different. So I thought, well, what if I didn't? What if I just said, okay, so fine, you're not hungry, you know, go off and play?
Mm-hmm.
And that was interesting, because then the next time that I fed them, they wanted to eat it because they knew that they wouldn't have anything else. So you kind of train them, like, not to be fussy. And also, if you don't react to them being fussy, it's right. not so much fun for them to be difficult with you. So it's kind of psychological as well as, you know, it's a way of inserting their independence. But, of course, it's all about the food as well, making food like small pieces of food they can pick up with their fingers. I would make chicken and apple balls with chicken and a tiny bit of apple because my son loved apple, wouldn't eat chicken. So put a bit of the apple into the chicken, made it into a small ball, and he loved picking those little balls up. So that was great. But, you know, you don't want to have to spend, like, 1 hour over a mealtime and they're eating tiny amounts of food and you're just, like, you know, getting more and more stressed. It's better you say, fine, you know, you're not hungry. You know, let's try it for the next meal. And then when they're hungry, that's when they'll eat something different. And I find that a lot of parents, like, they get stuck in a rut. There's a few things their children really eat, not necessarily particularly healthy things. And they just, like, they give those because it's, like, easier because then they know they're going to eat it.
Right.
But for me, I felt that I needed to give my children lots of different varieties of food to stop them being fussy and so that, you know, they could eat curries and, you know, all sorts of varieties of food in their early years, because it is what children eat in their early years that defines their diet for the rest of their life. They don't suddenly become a child, like, who's been eating chicken nuggets and chips and burgers into an adult who eats healthy food. They'll probably become an adult that eats junk food. So you want to make sure that you train them to love good food in those early formative years.
And so your adult children now are food lovers.
They are obsessed with food, literally. My son, unfortunately, had COVID quite badly and pneumonia, and he ended up coming back to live with me, and he has not moved out. He's been here now for the last 2.5 months, and it's because of the food.
Absolutely.
He loves my home cooking now. I mean, he just loves eating, so it's great. Mm-hmm. He's become from the world's worst eater to someone who's obsessed with food, so I must have done something right.
Absolutely, yeah. What do you think of cheese? Did you have dairy in your children?
Yes, I did. I mean, they weren't allergic to dairy. They weren't allergic to dairy food, so it was absolutely fine to give them dairy. And dairy, of course, you know, contains calcium, which is very important for children.
Yeah, I was just wondering, you know, it's so hard in our world today. There's so many different ideas around food, but the basis of food is really how it's done and how it's prepared, more than good food, bad food, if you're working from a whole foods diet.
Well, I think it's what you eat over a period of a week that matters. I mean, if a child, you know, I don't believe in the forbidden fruit, because if you make things like chocolate, like, they can never have chocolate, they're going to find chocolate somewhere else outside of the house. I think that if you allow them to have a little bit of sweet things, you know, within the diet they're having, they don't crave it because it's part of their everyday diet. So my children grew up loving salads, made amazing salad dressings. We always had, like, you know, cookies and things in the house, but because it was available, they didn't crave it. If I'd said you can't have a cookie and you can't have chocolate, they probably would have wanted it, but it was always there.
Yes, that's...
It wasn't necessarily what they wanted, because I made my healthy food taste so good.
Yeah. And at what age did they start help creating the food with you?
Well, very young. So I got them at the age of like 3, 4, and 6 to help make dinner on a Friday. And I would like chop the things for them and maybe put it in the oven, but I just let them get on, the three of them in the kitchen. And they absolutely loved it, and that's how they learned to cook. And actually, I've just written a kid's cookbook, and I do think, like, cooking... Every child loves to cook, and they're learning time, they're learning measuring, they're learning so many different skills. And if you can teach a child to cook, they'll end up being a healthier eater.
Yeah, for sure. And you also taught your children to work together on it. It wasn't just like, okay, you're on this night and you're on that night. You taught them how to interact and work together.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it was extremely messy when I went back in the kitchen.
I bet.
You know, they've all grown up to be quite good cooks as a result of that. And I also had cooking birthday parties, or when they had a play date, I would often do like a pizza and they would like design their own toppings and, you know, help make it. And kids love that. And it's just such a great thing to be able to do with your kids. it's an activity where they're learning, and they're learning a lot of maths. They're learning about geography. There's many things they're learning when they're cooking. And also when they cook something, they're often more likely to eat it.
It's a great teaching time for everything. We're going to go for a quick break, and then we'll be right back, Annabelle.